This podcast of Studio 360 is supported by Squarespace.com, helping to provide a way for anyone to create a professional-looking website or blog. For a free trial and special offer for Studio 360 listeners, visit Squarespace.com and use offer code STUDIO4.
Today in Studio 360,
I opened it up and started to read it, and my jaw dropped.
A poem reveals the secrets of the universe 2,000 years before science could back them up.
This is the actual beating heart, something coming back across the huge gap of time and changing the course of the human spirit.
I'll talk with the author of The Swerve, How the World Became Modern. It just won the Pulitzer Prize for nonfiction. And a poet writes a love letter to her rock idol.
Bowie will never die. Nothing will come for him in his sleep or charging through his veins. And he'll never grow old.
Tracy K. Smith's Life on Mars. I'm Kurt Anderson, artists that rock our world, today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Last week, the Pulitzer Prizes were announced. Today on the show, we'll hear from three of the winning authors: a poet, an historian, and a biographer who changed the way we understand the life of Malcolm X.
Malcolm takes the Hajj, and it transforms his life because he sees Europeans and Asians and Africans meeting in fellowship and in unity. And he says, this is what Islam truly is, and this is what I want to be.
But first, let's talk a little, about the economy. As the country keeps trying to shake off the Great Recession, we're accustomed to stories of corporate layoffs and manufacturing jobs outsourced overseas. But one group of Americans that's been hit harder than most, we don't hear much about: the creative class. The last few years have seen a huge drop-off in paying jobs for designers, architects, photographers, performers, and more. In an ongoing series for Salon, reporter Scott Timberg has written that, quote, "A working artist is seen neither as the salt of the earth by the left nor as a job creator by the right, but as a kind of self-indulgent parasite." Timberg thinks that if the U.S. wants to remain the leader in global culture, we ought to be a lot more worried about the people who create it.
Part of the glory of this country is we've created incredible amounts of culture over the years, movies, jazz, everything else. And America likes to think of itself as being a meritocracy. So what I think the real test is here: can a talented, hardworking person who's willing to commit to a field succeed in that field?
So when we talk about the creative class for the purposes of being special sufferers in the recession and its aftermath, what kinds of jobs are we talking about other than the ones I mentioned?
The part of the creative class we tend to hear about are the, you know, celebrities in each discipline, the Frank Gehrys, the Nicole Kidmans, the Drakes, and so on. And these people, from what I can tell, are doing fine. The people who work at what I call the middle class of the creative class, which could be an architect at a medium-sized firm, it could be a writer, could be somebody at a publishing house. These people have been hit very hard. There's also a group that I consider essential: people who help disseminate culture. And I mean people all the way down to the level of a bookstore clerk, a
right.
person at a record store who turns you on to a John Coltrane record.
It's the working stiffs who happen to be creative. Do we have a sense or a quantifiable notion of what the impact has been over the last 4 or 5 years since the recession began on these working categories?
The Bureau of Labor Statistics keeps pretty good numbers. And in fields like photography, architecture, graphic design, and I'm looking at not just the professionals but the people who work in these offices, there's anything from about a 20 to a 30% collapse over the last few years. Then you have fields like musical groups and artists, which includes a wide range of things. This is down by 45.3% since August 2002.
Wow. That's huge. And as you're suggesting, when you talk about graphic design firms or architectural firms, even musical entities, we're talking about not so much an artist alone in her studio, but small businesses, right? I mean, these are entrepreneurs. But one of your big point is that there is not much sympathy. Why is that? Just because America is America and we don't cotton to those highfalutin artist types?
You know, there are a lot of layers coming together. You know, some of them are kind of deep, you know, going back to the sort of Puritan foundings of the nation where art was seen as idolatry and this sort of dangerous thing. Part of it is more recent. It has to do with the definition of the cultural elite, with the idea that artists, people who like culture, who consume it, are not real Americans, are not really one of us. It also has to do with the fact that the story has really not been told. There are a lot of artists in various forms out there, but they don't always have a tattoo or a beret or an earring that announces them as an artist. You know, they're like Canadians. You know, they're sort of among us, you know, secretly, silently, invisibly.
When we're talking about creative artists and who have the privilege and the pleasure of earning a living painting or designing or doing whatever it is they do, doesn't this go with the territory and that relatively low pay and financial ups and downs?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think a creative field or a life in the arts has always been something where people knew they were giving up the, you know, giving up riches and were, you know, making a trade-off to do something they're passionate about. Recently, and I'm talking not just with the recession, but also with the sort of realignment of the economy through digital technology and so on, it's become forbidding for a much wider group of people.
Are the very talented people surviving better? That's what one in a meritocracy would hope.
I think it's fair to say that there's a lot less rhyme and reason than you would think. And again, people I know in the world of architecture, graphic design, photography, it would be disturbing, but less disturbing if people who were good but not great were suffering. But what I'm seeing is some of the very best, the most dedicated, getting knocked out.
No, and I suppose it's not as though a factory in a town is closing down. It's not wholesale layoffs of thousands of people. So it's one person here, a couple of people there, a few people there. So it doesn't have that kind of spectacular impact either.
That's right, yeah. And the way these things are covered in the press typically are these Horatio Alger stories where we hear about somebody who, as one architect in Los Angeles has done, you know, open a groovy ice cream truck. You know, I'm glad they did, but that's very much the exception in the larger story here.
Thanks so much, Scott.
Thank you, Kurt.
Scott Tinberg is an arts and culture writer based in Los Angeles. His ongoing series for Salon is called Art in Crisis. So what do you think? Are the economic hardships being suffered by members of the creative class a serious problem? Or are starving artists supposed to starve? Tell us at studio360.org. Coming up, when Tracy K. Smith was in college, she decided to say who she was.
When I look back, it feels a little pretentious. I remember I chose to declare that I was a poet. I remember my roommates at the time being so annoyed because I would say, I can't go out. I need to work on my poems.
She's up next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
This podcast of Studio 360 is supported by Squarespace.com, providing a way for anyone to create a quality website or blog. With hundreds of design templates and apps for updating on the go, Squarespace provides many features to create or update a website or blog, including widgets to display Flickr photos and messages from Facebook and Twitter. A free trial and special offer for Studio 360 listeners is available at Squarespace.com, offer code STUDIO4.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. And before I do anything else, I want to give a special welcome to those of you listening to Yellowstone Public Radio. Hello, Montana. It's great to have you. When it comes to living poets, we don't have enough household names in America to use up the fingers on one hand. But a new one may just have arrived. Tracy K. Smith is 40 years old, has 3 books of poetry published, and just won the Pulitzer Prize for her book, Life on Mars. Life on Mars covers that, literally, and science fiction, God, evil, father's death, becoming a mother, and David Bowie. It is serious and smart and profound, like poetry is supposed to be, but it's also accessible if you're not a poetry expert. Tracy K. Smith is here with me now. Welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you.
So congratulations.
Thank you.
And you actually learned you won the Pulitzer Prize on your 40th birthday?
I did, yeah. Monday, April 16th. Probably around the time I was born, too.
Really?
Which is kind of interesting.
You knew you were already a finalist?
No, I did not.
Nothing. You knew nothing. So this was really out of the blue.
It was really a surprise.
In my introduction, I described your work, which I like very much, as accessible. I realize that in some circles, that's probably offensive or a fighting word. How do you feel about it?
I don't feel offended by it. I actually feel happy about it. Like, I'm interested in using language and having fun with what it can do and what it can create, but using it as a tool to get toward understanding and insight. And if I'm thinking about something that is mysterious or difficult or complex, I like when the language can be as transparent as possible, just to make way for the larger thing.
And your project includes the world as we know it and live in it, and there's nothing wrong with referring again and again to David Bowie, for instance.
I gave myself permission many years ago to let anything that is interesting, even mildly important to me as a person, into my work. And around that time, I started realizing, oh, you know, I'm going to let David Bowie in. I'm going to let Frank Zappa. I'm going to let world events that that I had felt were not quote-unquote poetic in the past, let them into the work and see what happens.
Speaking of David Bowie, I'd love it if you'd read the first section of the poem, Don't You Wonder Sometimes.
Sure. Don't you wonder sometimes? After dark, stars glisten like ice, and the distance they span hides something elemental. Not God, exactly. More like some thin-hipped, glittering Bowie being, a star man or cosmic ace, hovering, swaying, aching to make us see. And what would we do, you and I, if we could know for sure that someone was there squinting through the dust, saying nothing is lost, that everything lives on, waiting only to be wanted back badly enough?
That was Tracy K. Smith reading from her poem, Don't You Wonder Sometimes, about David Bowie. Was Bowie an obsession of yours when you were a teenager?
I remember, watching some 1980s music videos like Let's Dance. It's not even, I guess, what we now agree as David Bowie's best moment. But as a kid, and then as I got older, I became really interested in the Ziggy Stardust era. I wasn't even a kid, I have to say. I was probably like 30 when I became kind of obsessed with that moment. And I think what was so powerful about it to me was the sense of the imagination as something that is capable of creating a whole new world and a whole new sense of self. And I really have always just been so grateful to that. And I wanted at some point to find a way of writing toward that in my work, acknowledging that.
The title of the book is from a Bowie song. Yeah?
Absolutely.
Life on Mars.
Take a look at the long man, beating up the wrong guy. Is there life on Mars?
I love the sense of looking at the sad, paltry, and yet very familiar spectacle that we must make from moment to moment in our lives and in our frenzy as something that's as out there as, you know, alien life.
Yeah. A big section of this book deals with your father's death a few years ago. You write, "Who were we without your clean profile nicking away at anything that made us afraid?" What was your dad like?
My father was, when I was growing up as a child, I thought of him as larger than life. I thought of him as this Renaissance man who could do anything.
He was a scientist.
He was an engineer.
Yeah.
And he was deeply interested in the world and how things worked and grew and transformed. And he loved making furniture, and he, you know, grew trees from seeds because he was curious about what would happen.
It's like a dad in a movie or something.
Yeah, I mean, I have very sweet memories of him. And when I got older, he became human in a way that was really wonderful. We became friends in a way.
Would you read one of the poems about him, the one called It's Not?
Sure. It's not that death was thinking of you or me or our family or the woman our father would abandon when he died. Death was thinking what it owed him, his ride beyond the body, its garments, beyond the taxes that swarm each year, the car and its fuel injection, the fruit trees heavy in his garden. Death led him past the aisles of tools, the freezers lined with meat, the television saying over and over, "Seek and ye shall find." So why do we insist he has vanished, that death ran off with our everything worth having? Why not that he was swimming only through this life, his slow, graceful crawl, shoulders rippling, legs slicing away at the waves, gliding further into what life itself denies. He has only gone so far as we can tell, though when I try, I see the white cloud of his hair in the distance like an eternity.
That's Tracy K. Smith reading It's Not from her new book, Life on Mars. He worked on the Hubble telescope.
Yes.
Which has obviously been sort of one of the big deal in observational astronomy the last several decades. How did that, having a father who did that, sort of shape your view of existence?
To be really honest with you, when he was working on the Hubble, I was 8 years old. I became really interested in looking at these images after he passed away.
Uh-huh.
And somehow
the images that the Hubble has captured.
Oh, yeah. And then I could remember I remember the first book that he received with some of those images in them and him showing them to me and telling me this is what I was able to help, you know, contribute to. And maybe it's taken that many years for that to really register for me.
And he's an engineer. You're a poet. Are those such different ways of thinking about the world? Did they lead to differences between you as father and daughter?
Well, I remember my father, although I never read one of the poems that he supposedly wrote when he was young, my mother would always tell me that when they were courting one another, my father would send her love poems that he had written. And I always felt like, okay, there's this kernel of connectedness that he and I share, even though we veered in these very different directions.
How did you start reading, caring about, and then writing poetry?
I guess there are all of these different starting points. The earliest one I can remember is grade school, writing a poem, and feeling wise. But when I was in college, I was lucky enough to be exposed to a lot of living poets. I was at Harvard in the early 90s, and Seamus Heaney taught there, and Lucy Brock Broido and Henri Cole were other really important teachers that I had. And, you know, I would see that poets were people who ordered meals and, you know, wore shoes and did all the things.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, exactly. And it seemed like something that I could imagine doing right then instead of waiting until I was at the end of my life.
Although it also, one can imagine, okay, thinking, on the other hand, I'm an undergraduate. This is an undergraduate folly, fancy. But you didn't have that. You said, no, I can actually do this.
When I look back, it's probably, it feels a little pretentious. I remember I chose to declare that I was a poet. And I remember my roommates at the time being so annoyed because I would say, I can't go out. I need to work on my poems. I need to stay home. But for me, I think what was happening was I was discovering a language for articulating some of those feelings that are normally inarticulable for somebody who's, you know, late adolescent.
I was shocked as I was reading this book on the day that Levon Helm, the drummer for the band, died, to see a poem dedicated to him. Well, how did that happen?
Well, I love the band, and it's a poem about
feeling frustrated, trying to write something, and then suddenly just listening to the music that's playing in the background and allowing that to be the gateway into the poem. And so that's really what happened.
Well, I was very happy because the band is one of my very favorite bands of all time to see that. Could you read the poem, Alternate Take?
Sure. Alternate Take for Lee Von Helm. I've been beating my head all day long on the same six lines, snapped off and whittled to nothing like the nub of a pencil, chewed up and smoothed over, yellow paint flecking my teeth. And this whole time, a hot wind's been swatting at my door, spat from his mouth and landing smack against my ear. All day, pounding the devil out of six lines and coming up dry, while he drives donuts through my mind's backwoods with that dirt road voice of his, kicking up gravel like a runaway Buick. He asks, should I come in with that backbeat? And whatever those six lines were bothered by skitters off like water in hot grease. Come in, Levon, with your lips stretched tight and that pig-eyed grin, bass mallet socking it to the drum. Lay it down like you know how. Shoulders hiked nice and high, chin tipped back, so the song has to climb its way out like a man from a mine.
That's Tracy K. Smith reading Alternate Take. Did you ever send Lee Von Helm that poem? Do you know if you ever read it?
I didn't send it to him. I really regret that now.
Tracy, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Just need some place where I can lay my head. Hey, mister, can you tell me where a man might find a bed? He just grinned and shook my hand. No was all he said.
Tracy K. Smith's latest collection of poetry is called Life on Mars, and it just won the Pulitzer Prize. So, how about you? Was there some rock star or other cultural figure you idolized when you were young? If so, we've got a new challenge for you. Write a poem about that person and post it at studio360.org. Then Tracy K. Smith will read your entries and come back in a couple of weeks to pick the winner here on the show. The deadline for our contest is May 6th at midnight. And speaking of celebrity obsessions, there's a new show by Cirque du Soleil touring the country right now called Michael Jackson, Immortal. Jackson's been dead for 3 years, but some of his fans are as devout as ever. So business is pretty good for the people who make their livings impersonating Michael Jackson. Roy Hurst caught up with a few of them in Los Angeles.
In spite of all his makeup, Sean Vezina doesn't look much like Michael Jackson. His loafers aren't quite right, his white socks have no sparkle, his fedora's a little too big, and at about 5 feet and 100 pounds, he's too short and maybe even too thin.
The look is, for me, it's enough. I'm not trying too hard, I'm not wearing any diamonds, there's no bling bling. This is Michael Jackson on his day off, is what I thought.
Can I get a picture with you?
Yeah, sure.
Don't get me wrong, people are drawn to Sean. He conjures something about Jackson that's hard to put a finger on. The MJ essence, I guess you could say.
One more.
I've experienced what it's really like for Michael Jackson. They want to go through me to get to him.
Now you got to do me a favor.
Bring it back to me so I can then sign it.
Will you be here? How am I going to find you?
I'll be on stage.
Okay, perfect.
I'll be on stage.
I'll be there. Thank you.
No, I'll be
there. At 31, Sean has been impersonating Jackson since 8th grade. So when Cirque du Soleil announced a tribute show called Michael Jackson Immortal, Sean saw it as his ticket and set out to make himself a permanent fixture on the tour. Tonight, he's standing outside Staples Center in downtown Los Angeles, where Immortal has a 3-day run. Each night of the show, Sean stands to make as much as $100 posing for photos with fans. For a homeless man, that kind of money goes a long way.
I've been on foot. I've been outside. I've been hurting. I've been
traveling,
yes. Like Forrest Gump, traveling. Literally, Forrest Gump.
There are Michael Jackson impersonators all over the world. The profession seemed to get a shot in the arm immediately after Jackson died in 2009. That night in Harlem, crowds gathered outside the Apollo Theater to celebrate the singer's life. All kinds of Michael Jacksons showed up, some with dance skills to match the look. These days, if you're an MJ impersonator, Hollywood Boulevard is a good place to be seen.
For me, this is a job.
And it's a good job for Javon Rimeau. He has the rare advantage of looking like Jackson naturally.
I'm the black Michael Jackson, right? If Michael didn't have the surgery, this is how he would look.
For 8 hours a day, Javon stands with a frozen smile next to Jackson's star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. He's not the only lookalike on the boulevard. There's Darth Vader and Marilyn Monroe and the guy from the Pirates of the Caribbean and the Hulk. But Javon is by far most popular with tourists. The tourist asks to take his picture. He asks for a donation. They ask how much. He discreetly shows them a $5 bill. The deal is made. The picture is taken. The tourist, the lookalike, and Michael Jackson's star all in the frame.
I said to Spider-Man, one of the Spider-Man guys, and I said, I made $560. And he said, no way, no one makes that kind of money on the boulevard. And I said, I did. He said, no, you're lying. He said, not even Superman makes that kind of money. And so a lot of times when I'm here, they're not so thrilled.
An immigrant from Haiti, Javon was bussing tables at a restaurant in Miami in the 1980s when people began to notice the resemblance.
I started to believe it. Then this lady agent came up to me and says, we're looking for a lookalike, and I can make money, they can make money.
Before long, he was booking gigs around the world. But most MJ impersonators don't have it that easy. Sean Vezina had to work to find his inner Michael.
I was 12 years old, and I saw a concert on HBO live when it aired, and it was amazing. And then just a few months later, Michael was interviewed by Oprah Winfrey. After that interview, I made it official. I said, I want to be like Mike. We had the cassette of Thriller. I played it back to back to back to back, you know, for the rest of the night, for the rest of that night. You know, everybody went to bed. I stayed in the kitchen. And just every day since then, I slowly started to learn to dance.
Over and over and over in slow motion, I would watch his stuff stop and start, like, you know, inch by inch. It was a huge dance challenge to me.
That's Devra Gregory. And Devra's MJ is pretty tight, especially considering she's a 53-year-old white woman. Her dancing is remarkable, and her look even more so.
My look, I would say, is the 90s look. The long-haired Jerry curl, like from the Dangerous album.
The whole thing started for Devra 12 years ago when she was working the backup dance line for the all-male drag show La Caja Falls. She thought a drag act as Michael Jackson could get her a featured spot in the show.
I secretly began to look at the makeup. You know, drag queens are masters at disguise. And so I learned some really excellent makeup techniques and wig and what to do with foam rubber, how to alter your body.
Finally, she presented her act to Lakaja's producer.
He said, you know, it looks okay, but keep working on it. Come back in a few months. It's kind of like the Wizard of Oz, you know, go away and come back. And he put me back in the dance line. So by then I had a taste of being a celebrity impersonator and I didn't want to go back into the dance line. So I left the show to pursue Michael more fully.
More fully means a TV show or a video here or there, but mostly corporate events, private parties, weddings, and bar mitzvahs.
But once I'm on the job, I don't give it away that I'm a woman, and a lot of people just can't even tell.
I love Michael Jackson. He saved my life, man. I mean, Michael gave me a ticket to a better life.
But if you dig a little further with Javon, you'll find a thick layer of frustration just below all the gratitude. He wants to be considered a legitimate actor in his own right. And in the early 1990s, Jackson was giving him reason to take off the sparkling glove.
Michael Jackson was bugging the hell out of me when he was turning white. It was that moment when I was studying the role to be Marcus Garvey, and I realized, wait a minute, what the hell Michael Jackson is doing to himself, messing up his features, his beautiful features. And that's when I left the business, the Michael Jackson thing.
Who is the real Michael Jackson? You know, they're all the real Michael Jacksons. We all have the right to look however we want.
I know a great-looking black guy who performs in Vegas, and yet he paints himself white to look like Michael Jackson. I don't see Michael Jackson as a color.
I don't want to be here. It's hurting my soul every time I'm here.
By the time Michael Jackson died, Jovan Rameau's acting career had slowed down. With all the renewed interest in Jackson, he couldn't resist the opportunity. He went back on the boulevard.
Every time I put on this makeup and the wig, and it hurts me because it's not what I set out to do. But it's okay, you know, people smiling. Hi.
Hi, can we have a photo with you?
Of course you can. Why are you asking? Why do you want to take a picture with me? Why?
You have to be willing to take a day and not collect any money and be okay with that.
Tonight, Sean Vezina will sleep in the park across the street from the Hollywood Bowl, where the Jackson 5 once played.
Today, I was lucky to have made $30. I got $23 left to my name right now. You know, but at the end of each night, it's cash in your pocket, tax-free. That's how I look at it.
Cirque du Soleil's Michael Jackson Immortal will be off to the next city in a couple of days. Sean hopes to be there.
Because it keeps me sane. That would be the final answer if it was a game show.
For Studio 360, I'm Roy Hurst.
The city's heart begins to beat. Reaching out, I touch her shoulder. I'm dreaming of a street. If they say why, why?
You can see pictures of some of those performers in Roy's story at studio360.org. Coming up, Kevin Barnes from the band of Montreal learns the secrets of rock and roll from Mick and Keith.
I couldn't write anything that was as cool as those Stone songs. I understand the chords, but I didn't understand how much of it was the attitude.
That's up next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. 2 years ago, I had the good fortune to talk at length with the historian Manning Marable. He was just putting the finishing touches on his biography of one of America's most mythologized figures, Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention. Marable died last year, but his book just received the 2012 Pulitzer Prize for History.
A historian's obligation is to find out things he could not possibly know. I discovered, for example, the police officer who spent a year of his life illegally wiretapping Malcolm X, and I got his story. And it was fascinating because Malcolm converted a white cop from New York in the 60s simply by listening to the wiretaps. And he said, this guy is not an enemy. He's a good guy.
You can hear more of my conversation with the late, great Manning Marable at studio360.org. And one more Pulitzer winner today, The Swerve, How the World Became Modern by Stephen Greenblatt. It's about an ancient poem called On the Nature of Things, and when I read Greenblatt's book last year, it kind of blew my mind. The Roman poet Lucretius wrote On the Nature of Things 2,000 years ago, and he put into it radical new philosophical and scientific ideas, a millennium or two before their time. The poem was lost and then found and then lost and found again in a story, an amazing story that stretches across centuries.
The poem is very beautiful. It begins with a passionate, remarkable hymn to the goddess Venus, a hymn that inspired Botticelli's Primavera and other wonderful Renaissance works of art. At its core, it has a set of philosophical ideas. And the very central idea is about physics. And the idea from physics is this, that the world consists of tiny, indestructible, eternal, indivisible particles, which the Greeks called atoms. This Roman poet called them the seeds of things. And it consists of an infinite number of these atoms and nothing else, the void. The atoms are constantly in movement. They were never created and they'll never die.
In other words, they got it right early.
By our lights, they got it right, astonishingly right. And it's not just that they got that right, but Lucretius and the philosophers that he's following began to try to work out the implications of this strange and powerful idea, starting with the fact a universe that's made up out of atoms and emptiness forever has no designer or creator. It was done entirely naturally over untold billions and trillions of years. Now, we start from that.
So the story, as you tell it, really takes off with your account of this 15th century book hunter called
Poggio Bracciolini.
Who's this guy who pokes around old monasteries in the early 15th century around Europe looking for important ancient texts. Who was this guy?
He was a bureaucrat working most of his career for a succession of popes in the Vatican, and worked his way up largely for a strange reason, because he had magnificently beautiful handwriting.
Yeah.
But he always had this other slightly weird thing in him, which was the desire to find ancient books.
Which was a particularly interesting thing for a guy who works for the Pope to be doing, since these ancient books had been, for at that point, suppressed by the Christian Church for 1,000 or more years.
The church had a rather complicated love-hate relationship to the heritage of pagan antiquity. Many, in fact, most of the great early church founders were steeped in ancient pagan learning and literature. And what they felt was that they wanted to hold on to what was beautiful and powerful in that literature, but also destroy what was unacceptable.
And one of those unacceptable ideas in the poem is that the great human desire that drives everything is the maximization of human pleasure and the minimization of human pain.
It certainly doesn't sound like such a strange idea to us. They observed, as we would observe, that all creatures, including humans, go toward pleasure and away from pain. But what was unusual for them is that they said that this was the highest good, that everything about the structure of life had to begin and end with this desire to enhance pleasure and to diminish pain. And Lucretius actually thought a lot about sex because, after all, doesn't take a genius to understand that there's a relationship between sex and pleasure.
They understood that even in 50 BC, I guess.
Even in 50 BC. But he also was troubled by these thoughts of sex because he understood, and this was also grasped in 50 BC, that there's a relationship between sex and pain. And that poses a problem for someone of his thinking. How is it, if he is opposing pain and pleasure, that the highest form of human pleasure, at least as many people feel, is also oddly associated with pain? Even in the hour of possession, he writes, the passion of the lovers fluctuates and wanders in uncertainty. They cannot decide what to enjoy first with their eyes and hands. They tightly squeeze the object of their desire and cause bodily pain, often driving their teeth into one another's lips and crushing mouth against mouth. And then he goes in closer to try to actually see the lovers in the moment of their ecstasy. And this is a translation done of these lines by the great 17th century English poet John Dryden. When the youthful pair more closely join, when hands in hands they lock and thighs they twine, just in the raging foam of full desire, when both press on, both murmur, both expire, they grip, they squeeze, their humid tongues they dart, as each would force their way to the other's heart, in vain they only cruise about the coast, for bodies cannot pierce, nor be in bodies lost, as sure they strive to be, when both engage in that tumultuous momentary rage, so tangled in the nets of love they lie, till man dissolves in that excess of joy.
That's Stephen Greenblatt reading from Lucretius's poem On the Nature of Things from 2,000 years ago. So once this was rediscovered, how did its effects and its view ripple through the wider world over the next several hundred years?
In the immediate moment, there was scarcely a ripple at all. And once it did begin to circulate, it was very hard to figure out what it was, really, because in the case of this poem, a poem which said that the soul was made up out of atoms as well as the body, and therefore the soul must die with the body. There's no afterlife, no rewards, no punishment. With this poem, people scratched their heads and wondered what this was, what it was saying. And the people who actually got what it was saying became alarmed. And it's only really after 100 years, after 200 years, that you begin to see it pressing its way more intensely into people's consciousness, but even then very, very, very dangerously.
And when we say dangerously, we mean most specifically because it threatened the Christian dogma.
Yeah, first of all, Christianity is a religion that was committed to saving souls. And what saving souls meant for early Christians was to save them from error. If you feel that, if you feel that you have to save people from eating, as they would have called it, poison bread, then you have to actually get rid of the stuff that might poison them. And that meant getting rid of the people who might be carrying the poison. Anyone who embraced this set of beliefs would have been killed in this early period. Indeed, there are some instances of people imprisoned or killed.
And The Swerve, which is the title of the book, it refers to the fact that civilization swerved toward what we now regard as the modern by the various merest chance that this poem continued to exist and then happened to be discovered and then made its subversive way through civilization?
My title, The Swerve, refers to the fact that something happened. This is the actual beating heart, the specific instance of that Renaissance at its most radical, something coming back across the huge gap of time and changing the course of the human spirit, of human thought. But it isn't the only meaning of the swerve, because there are swerves of other kinds. There was the swerve that led to the disappearance of this text. Cultures don't move in one direction. They don't move in predictable directions. It's possible for an entire civilization to give up on its reading, to give up on its books. The libraries were shut down in the 5th and 6th centuries. The schools were shut down. People stopped copying books. Things began to disappear. That's also a swerve.
The Dark Ages.
Yes. And behind that whole set of questions of why cultures move in one direction or another, there's another swerve, which is, that's the term that Lucretius used to describe why anything exists at all, that each atom must have tiny movement. Almost, it can be almost indescribably small, a tiny swerve out of the straight line. And all you need, in fact, is a single atom having that swerve out of the straight line, and things begin to bang together and separate. Things begin to create into shapes. Things begin to pull apart. And indeed, for Lucretius, for this whole tradition, that swerve meant the possibility of human freedom.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, Kurt. It's a pleasure.
Stephen Greenblatt is a professor of humanities at Harvard. His book is called The Swerve, How the World Became Modern. It just won the Pulitzer Prize for nonfiction. To close the show today, we'll hear from Kevin Barnes. He's the lead singer of the Band of Montreal. They've made a name for themselves with their theatrical, over-the-top shows that hark back to the heyday of glam rock. But Kevin Barnes was not a born performer. He was an awkward teenager who says he had no friends at all until he discovered how to play rock and roll. It happened one summer at a campground.
My family used to go on camping trips all the time. That was just a thing we did in the summertime. And this is in Ohio. 13, just getting into music, but it was all very mysterious to me. You know, like, I didn't understand anything about production or songwriting. And I had this uncle who brought a guitar to the campground. And I was like, oh, man, I really want to play the guitar. So I asked him if he'd show me something. And, so we're sitting in this hot pop-up camper, and the first thing he showed me how to do was how to play Under My Thumb by the Rolling Stones. Just that the riff that's actually played on a marimba. That do 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 do. He's shown me, you know, how to hold the guitar pick and where to put your fingers. And then he taught me the chords. And we started singing it. Under my thumb, the girl who once had me down. It probably was really rough, you know, like if someone's like trying to like remember where to put their fingers, that was like extremely slow and awkward, but I'm sure it didn't sound very good, but to my ears it sounded beautiful.
Oh yeah, the difference in the clothes she wears down to me, a change has come, she's under my thumb.
And it's sort of a revelation for me. You can, you know, learn those simple things pretty quickly, and then the whole world of pop music opens up to you. And for some people it might seem really lame, but for me, you know, as a 13-year-old, I was just like, I couldn't even believe it. You know, like, oh, wow, okay, so I can play that song, but now I can also play like every Rolling Stone song ever written just because I know like how to do that one thing. Around that time period, I got this collection of Rolling Stone singles. It's called The London Years, I think. And like, especially the early songs were pretty simplistic. So I would just sit in my bedroom and play the tape and just listen to it and try to figure out, okay, so which bar chord would that be? You know, okay. And that's how, you know, sort of uncovered the secrets of songwriting. Just from learning that one Rolling Stone song, I was able to, you know, learn Beatles songs and the Hollies, the Kinks, the Who. I just really dove headfirst into it and spent all my time playing the guitar. I kind of lost interest in everything else. Then I started writing my own songs, you know, using those chords and probably lifting a lot of the melody lines as well.
Damn, wish you were born. Born a girl, so I could have been your boyfriend. I know it's not possible now. I just never met a girl I like half as much as you and we.
But the funny thing was, I remember being frustrated that I couldn't write anything that was as cool to me as those Stone songs. Like, what is it? Like, I understand the chords, But I didn't understand at the time, like, how much of it was, like, the attitude. It took a while for me to get to the point where I, you know, sort of dug myself and happy that I had my own personality and my own style. Some of my songs, if I would just take like one section of the song, that would be most people's whole song. Like on the new record, there's a song called Dollar Percentage, and it's kind of exhausting, you know, it's like chord, 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 chord. It never stops changing chords. And I think it's just the way my mind works. But I'm always trying to create the hook, not a generic hook, something that feels special and has that magical spark to it. That's the thing about the Stones. They always had really great melody lines, and they're fairly simple, but each one's fantastic.
Kevin Barnes from the band Of Montreal. Of Montreal's new album is called Paralytic Stalks. Studio 360's Lital Molad produced our story with help from Max Bernstein. And that's it for this week. Thanks very much for listening. And don't forget about our new poetry challenge. Write a poem about some star, the star, who rocked your teenage world. And Pulitzer Prize poet Tracy K. Smith will be back to pick the winner. Post your work at studio360.org. Studio 360 is a production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Lital Molad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogerson,
Alana Harper,
Rebecca Lee Douglas,
Thomas Seeley,
Krista Ripple.
And thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegen.
Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
45 years ago, S.E. Hinton broke every rule for young adult fiction and created an American icon.
Something bad can happen at any moment, and there's nothing you can do about it. There's no trusted adult that they turn to, and people die.
Way before The Hunger Games, there was The Outsiders. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.